Hello, and welcome to Historical True Crime, the podcast where we take a look back at history's darkest crimes and criminals. I'm your host, Lizzie, and today is episode 60. For this episode, we're delving into the mysterious case that has captivated the nation for decades, the mystery of D.B. Cooper. On a stormy night on November 24th, 1971, a man only known as D.B. Cooper boarded Northwest Orient Airlines Flight 305, a seemingly ordinary flight from Portland to Seattle. Little did the crew and passengers know, this unassuming flight was about to become the backdrop for one of the most audacious and unsolved crimes in American history. Cooper calmly handed a note to the flight attendant that revealed a chilling message. He claimed to have a bomb and demanded $200,000 in cash and 4 parachutes. What followed next was a series of events that would baffle investigators, capture the public's imagination, and spawn countless theories about Cooper's identity and ultimate fate. In this episode, we'll unravel the events leading up to that fateful night, explore the daring hijacking itself, and sift through the myriad of clues left behind by a man who vanished without a trace. Join us as we navigate through the turbulence of the D.B. Cooper case, attempting to separate fact from fiction, and shedding light on the lingering question, who was D.B. Cooper, and whatever became of him? But before we dive into the mysterious disappearance of D.B. Cooper, let's set the stage by exploring the unsettling era that preceded his hijacking. The early 1970s marked a tumultuous time in aviation history, with a series of hijackings leaving an indelible mark on the American psyche. Our journey begins in 1961, when Antulio Ramirez Ortiz made headlines by diverting a National Airlines flight to Key West, Florida. This would mark the first ever recorded hijacking in the United States, setting a precedent that would be unfortunately followed by others seeking their own paths to destinations, both real and metaphorical. Fast forward to March 1, 1962, when John W. Brown hijacked an American Airlines flight, demanding $100,000 and a parachute. Brown's bold move set the stage for a wave of hijackings, each with its own unique twist. In 1969, Luis Armando Panasoltrin, along with 2 accomplices, hijacked Eastern Airlines Flight 175. This incident highlighted the political motivations that sometimes fueled these actions during the tense Cold War era. The early 70s continued this disconcerting trend. On November 10, 1972, Richard O'Hare successfully hijacked a Northwest Orient Airlines flight, demanding a ransom of $500,000. O'Hare and his accomplices then parachuted out of the plane, leaving the pilots to safely land the aircraft. And just months before D.B. Cooper's infamous act on June 23, 1972, Martin J. McNally hijacked an American Airlines flight, demanding a ransom of just over $502,000. McNally would parachute over Indiana, marking a dangerous trend of extortion from the skies. June 29, 1972, saw yet another hijacking attempt, this time by Garrett Brock Trapnell, a former Army pilot. His plan, though thwarted, underscored the ongoing challenge of ensuring the safety and security of air travel during this turbulent period. These incidents paved the way for heightened security measures and raised awareness about the vulnerability of commercial flights. But little did the world know that the most perplexing hijacking of all was yet to come. The infamous act of D.B. Cooper. According to Krajac for Crime Library, a Boeing 727-100 flight number 305 had taken off from Washington, D.C. earlier in that day. It was transporting passengers to Minneapolis, the hub for the Northwest, and would then stop in Great Falls and Missoula, Montana, before heading west towards Portland. The long day would come to an end with a quick trip to Seattle. The aircraft had 94 seats, including 66 in coach and 28 in first class, but it was only carrying 37 people when the 5 crew members locked the doors and got ready to take off. Captain William Scott, 51 years old, a 20-year veteran of the Northwest, First Officer Bob Radizak, Flight Engineer H.G. Anderson, and 2 more inexperienced flight attendants, Tina Mucklow, 22, and Florence Schaffner, 23, who had each flown fewer than 24 months, would comprise the Minneapolis-based crew. A man who gave the name Dan Cooper purchased a one-way aircraft ticket from Portland to Seattle on November 24, 1971. Seated in seat 18C, he boarded a Northwest Orient Airlines Flight 305. Nothing indicated that the flight would be anything other than routine, and the trip usually took approximately 30 minutes. Dan Cooper appeared to be an ordinary passenger at first. His briefcase furthered the idea that he was a business traveler, as did his black tie and white shirt. Cooper would swiftly light a cigarette and ordered a drink, a bourbon and soda, which he consumed discreetly as the plane took off, just like many other passengers did of that era. His unassuming appearance was later reflected in the FBI file notes. It said, white male, 6'1", tall, 170 to 175 pounds, age mid-40s, black hair, brown eyes, olive complexion, traditional cut, parted on the left. However, Cooper would later notice Florence Schaffner, a stewardess. He would pass her a piece of paper, and Schaffner would place the note into her pocket, assuming he was passing her his phone number. After all, she was fairly used to men making passes at her. But Cooper would later lean forward and say, "Miss, you'd better take a look at that note. I have a bomb." Schaffner would tear open the note. "I have a bomb in my briefcase" was scrawled in capital letters using a felt-tip pen. A terrifying statement. "I want you to sit next to me." And sinking into the seat beside Cooper, Schaffner asked to see the explosive. Cooper opened the briefcase calmly, and Schaffner peered inside and saw red rods that resembled dynamite, a battery, and a tangle of wires. What was Cooper's demand? "I want $200,000 by 5 p.m., Cooper would state calmly. "In cash, put in a knapsack. I want two back parachutes and two front parachutes. And when we land, I want a fuel truck ready to refuel. No funny stuff, or I'll do the job." According to Natale for Popular Mechanics, this is the first indication that Cooper was not your typical hijacker. Cooper asked for four parachutes, presumably to give the impression to anyone below that he was planning to kidnap a hostage. He might have been given dummy chutes so he could have fallen to his death instead of escaping with the money if he'd only asked for two. Parachuting typically requires only two chutes, the primary and the backup. Schaffner would go to the pilot, who announced over the intercom that the plane would need to circle before landing because of a mechanical issue. And for about 2 hours, the plane would circle the sky while ground personnel frantically tried to meet D.B. Cooper's requests. Cooper paid particular attention to the details in his planning by asking for $20 bills. It seems that he determined that 10,000 $20 bills would only come to around 21 pounds. Smaller denominations would make his skydive heavier and riskier, while bigger denominations would be harder to use since they'd be more noticeable. Cooper would also stipulate that the bill's serial numbers should be random rather than sequential. And while carrying out his instructions, FBI agents made sure that, even though they were random serial numbers, every banknote would start with the code letter L, which was issued by the San Francisco Federal Reserve Office. The bills were also almost all from 1969. The agents hurriedly took pictures of every bill to produce a microfilm record of all 10,000 serial numbers against the ticking clock. The plane landed in Seattle at 5:39 p.m., At this point, Cooper was approached by airline employees bearing the cash and the parachute systems. McCord Air Force Base supplied the first two parachutes. Cooper accepted them and then asked for two more. Given that they were military grade and would open after a 200-foot fall, it's possible that the original parachutes wouldn't have been suitable for his task. However, the second set of parachutes were carried in from a nearby skydiving area. They were sport parachutes. And before these parachutes opened, they would let someone fall freely for several thousand feet. It was at this point that the 36 passengers were now freed by the hijacker D.B. Cooper. He also released Florence Schaffner and another member of the crew. Cooper then requested to travel to Mexico City and agreed that the pilot would stop in Reno for fuel because the plane was not equipped to travel the 2,200 miles to the new destination. He did make certain demands before the flight could take off. They had to maintain a speed below 200 knots, fly below 10,000 feet, and keep the wing flaps at a 15-degree angle. The back door was also supposed to stay open. The plane started to get quite cold inside. Cooper sent the crew to the cockpit. It was later stated by four crew members that the temperatures dipped below zero. Then around 8 p.m., they saw that the rear air stairs had been lowered when a caution light flashed in the cockpit. Crew members also saw a sharp upward motion coming from the back of the aircraft around 15 minutes later. For almost 2 more hours, they'd stay huddled together in the bitter cold. When the plane touched down in Reno at approximately 10:15 p.m., the FBI and local police surrounded it right away. They would go inside and do a nose-to-tail search of the aircraft. However, neither D.B. Cooper nor the stolen funds were present. The hijacker couldn't have left the aircraft while on the ground without being noticed, according to authorities. The only things left behind were two parachutes and a black clip-on tie. In hindsight, the best chance of apprehending the hijacker may have been a straightforward cops and robbers strategy. Trail the hijacker to the ground, follow the plane, and wait for him to jump. Police did attempt to do this, but a dubious choice of chase jet cost them their opportunity. Two F-106 fighter jets were recalled by the Air Force from McCord. The pilots were told to keep a safe distance behind and keep an eye out for a jumper. However, the fighter jets were designed to reach 1,500 miles per hour in flight. In low altitude, slow motion surveillance, they were almost worthless. A slow moving Lockheed T-33 from the Air National Guard was sent up by authorities in an attempt to recover the mission, but by the time it got there, Cooper had most likely already jumped. And the cops couldn't check the ground until the next day due to bad weather that evening. They conducted a thorough search that Thanksgiving and for several weeks thereafter, but were unable to locate either the hijacker or the parachute. In the unlikely event that the hijacker had actually used his true identity, the authorities started looking up Dan Cooper in criminal records, but were ultimately unsuccessful. They did discover that Dan Cooper was not his true identity. And the media story that the hijacker's name was D.B. Cooper contributed to a misunderstanding, and the name did stick. Air piracy charges were first brought in 1976 and are still pending. An 8-year-old child did discover a bundle of $20 bills in the Columbia River on February 10, 1980, and the serial numbers matched those from the Cooper stash. There are many who think that this information lends credence to the theory that Cooper did not survive the fall. Additional searches in that area were prompted by the finding of these bundles. But any surviving hints on the Cooper case, however, were probably erased by the May 18, 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens. And no other trace of Cooper's bills have ever been found. In the 5 years after the crime, the FBI looked into over 800 people and pursued thousands of leads. However, according to MortonForHistory.com, there have been several prominent suspects over the years, but none have ever been charged. A man using a false identity boarded a flight from Newark to Los Angeles on April 7, 1972. He would hand a note to a flight attendant shortly after takeoff. Four parachutes and $500,000 were demanded in the note. The man, an experienced skydiver and helicopter pilot, threatened to bomb the aircraft if these things weren't provided. The hijacker would trade people for cash and parachutes. The 727 landed and refueled, and then on the way to his next location, he leapt from the back steps to freedom. Fewer than 5 months had passed since the D.B. Cooper incident, which raised suspicions that the same person might have been behind both hijackings. Richard McCoy Jr., the April crimes perpetrator, was found guilty of air piracy and sentenced to 45 years in jail. But on August 10, 1974, he and a few other prisoners would break out of their Pennsylvania prison by hijacking a garbage truck. 3 months later, when the FBI was able to locate McCoy in Virginia, a shootout would claim his life. Sheridan Peterson would also come under suspicion only a week after the hijacking, but wasn't interrogated by the FBI until decades later, and has been a more under-the-radar suspect over the years. A former Boeing employee, Peterson was part of the team that had authored the flight handbook for the hijacked Boeing 727, which could have helped explain how the culprit knew that the plane had back steps he could open and jump from. Peterson, a skilled skydiver, was employed as a smoke jumper in Montana for a while. In the early 1960s, he was employed at a skydive center, which would be the same skydiving center that would subsequently supply Cooper with the parachutes he used to make his escape. But in contrast to Cooper's depiction, Peterson's eyes were blue and not brown. Furthermore, Peterson is not known to have smoked, despite the fact that Cooper had chain-smoked during his flight. Although he provided no concrete evidence that he hadn't traveled from Nepal at the time of the kidnapping, Peterson told investigators that that's where he was living with his wife and family at the time of the hijacking. Pilot Robert Rackstraw, a former paratrooper, was busy back in the 1970s. A few of the offenses for which he was apprehended include grand theft, $75,000 in counterfeit checks, and the potential murder of his stepfather. Rackstraw felt it appropriate to stage his own death in 1978 after being cleared of the murder allegation. Making a fictitious Mayday call from a rented aircraft in Northern California, he was imprisoned for 2 years for both check fraud and aircraft theft. Authors Thomas Colbert and Tom Saluzzi provided information they collected from a 5-year investigation into Rackstraw's background in their 2016 book, The Last Master Outlaw. After coming to the conclusion that he was in fact the legendary hijacker, Rackstraw's attorney referred to this as, quote, "the stupidest thing I've ever heard." Rackstraw passed away on July 9, 2019, due to cardiac arrest. Kenneth Christensen was another person directly connected to the Cooper incident because he was employed as a mechanic, flight attendant, and purser by Northwest Airlines, the airline that was hijacked. According to Kenneth's brother Lyle in 1994, as he lay dying, Kenneth reportedly remarked, quote, "There is something you should know, but I cannot tell you." Kenneth was a paratrooper in the armed forces, and he did make a cash purchase of a house the year following the D.B. Cooper hijacking, even though he was only paid a menial flight attendant income. But it should be noted that Kenneth also did not match the description of Cooper. Later, Larry Carr, a case agent from Seattle, stated that D.B. Cooper was probably not a very good skydiver. Carr remarked in 2007 that, "At first we thought Cooper was an experienced jumper, perhaps even a paratrooper. After a few years, we came to the conclusion that this was just untrue. Any seasoned paratrooper would never have made the leap in a trench coat and loafers on a pitch black night in the rain with wind gusting up to 200 miles per hour. It was just too dangerous." The FBI would formally declare in July of 2016 that they would no longer be devoting active resources to pursuing the D.B. Cooper case. However, this did not imply that the mystery surrounding Cooper's identity had been resolved. But the investigators' main hypothesis is still that Cooper did not survive his jump. In a news release, the FBI stated that on July 8, 2016, the FBI redirected resources allocated to the D.B. Cooper case in order to focus on other investigative priorities, after one of the longest and most exhaustive investigations in our history. The FBI nevertheless urges anyone with specific physical evidence, such as additional cash or fragments of a parachute, get in touch with their local field office, even if the case is no longer open. The Cooper hijacking and its imitations served as a catalyst for the realization that airplanes were susceptible to air piracy. Boeing 727-100 aircraft were equipped with a Cooper vane device in 1973, which prevented passengers from using the aft stairs while in flight. The FAA started requiring passengers in carry-on bags to be screened that same year. While the number of hijackings decreased, the number of lethal political attacks against innocent aviation travelers increased. In September 1974, 88 people were killed when a plane traveling from Tel Aviv to New York was bombed. Other noteworthy events include the 1988 bombing of Pan American Flight 103 over Scotland, which was sponsored by Libya and resulted in the deaths of 270 people. Thanks to additional security improvements in the 1990s, America experienced a historic decade without a hijacking event starting in 1991. That came to an end on September 11, 2001, when the deadliest ever series of hijackings occurred. Now, independent investigators and amateur detectives are still diving into the D.B. Cooper case to this day. Known as Cooperites, they pore over every scrap of information they can find and even organize CooperCons to debate the mystery and consider suspects and hypotheses. So the case, even though no longer active with the FBI, does remain active for the amateur detective. And with that, we find ourselves at the end of another episode of Historical True Crime. The enigma surrounding Cooper's disappearance continues to perplex, leaving us with more questions than answers. We've retraced the steps of those who came before him, the daring souls who hijacked planes in pursuit of elusive goals. whether driven by political motives, financial gain, or the sheer audacity of escape. D.B. Cooper, however, remains the master of mystery. His mid-air heist on that stormy night in 1971 captured the world's imagination, and the unresolved questions persist to this day. Who was D.B. Cooper? Did he survive his daring parachute jump into the night, or did the wilderness below become his final resting place? As we conclude this chapter, we invite you, our fellow detectives in the historical true crime journey, to share your theories, insights, and speculations. Connect with us on social media. Let's keep the conversation alive. The tale of D.B. Cooper remains an open book, waiting for someone to decipher its final pages. And please remember to review, rate, subscribe if you've enjoyed this episode of Historical True Crime. You can find us on Instagram at Historical True Crime Pod or on Facebook at Historical True Crime Podcast. You can also reach us by email at historicaltruecrimepod@gmail.com. And feel free to send us any feedback or any suggestions of things you'd like us to cover in an upcoming episode. And we'll see you next week for another dark and notorious case from history. We'll see you then.